The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coroners are elected, medical examiners are not, but both help counties tally how and why people die. Now more than a month into this pandemic, and with more than 500 Pennsylvanians dead from COVID-19, how are their roles evolving? Sarah Simon is a reporter who asked that question recently for Spotlight PA. Sarah, how do medical examiners and coroners across the state view their jobs right now?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, that's the question that coroners and medical examiners themselves are asking of the state. It seems there's been a kind of weeks-long disagreement between coroners and medical examiners with Department of Health officials in Pennsylvania. Now, the coroners are looking at the stat. I'll say coroners. In most counties, it's a coroner. Three counties in Pennsylvania have a medical examiner. That's Allegheny, Delaware, and Philadelphia. And the coroners are looking at the statute that says, look, their role is to investigate deaths known or suspected to be due to contagious disease or constituting a public hazard. And I think everybody would agree that COVID-19 is a contagious disease. And now what the Department of Health is saying is, you know, let's step back a minute and let's look at the beginning of the statute. And the beginning of the statute says that, you know, deaths that are natural deaths, deaths that occur from natural causes, deaths that can be properly certified by a physician and don't have any kind of suspicious behavior, don't need to go to a coroner or a medical examiner.
Right. So why do the coroners think it's important for them to be involved in certifying that someone died from COVID?
So the coroners are saying that, you know, investigating deaths in a community is precisely what their role is, precisely what they are elected or appointed to do. They, you know, talking with the president of the Coroners Association in Pennsylvania, he says, look, they have the boots on the ground already. They've built relationships with physicians, with county officials, with first responders. They know how to do this work. They know how to properly follow through with kind of informing families with tracking how these deaths are occurring and building an accurate death count. Something I also heard from a number of coroners that I thought was really interesting is that it's that relationship with the funeral homes and with the first responders that they have already established that's particularly important in the COVID-19 crisis is, you know, properly communicating with a funeral director about whether or not this body that's being sent to their office, to their funeral home, you know, if they need to take proper precautions with it, especially, you know, given the contagious disease. So what the coroners essentially are saying is that, look, this is what we know how to do. Please, you know, respect the statute. This is what we're obligated to do. And the Department of Health doesn't see it that way.
So it seems like it's more than poor communication.
Well, the other piece of this puzzle is the question of when these deaths aren't being sent to the coroners, what does that mean? You know, who are the people who are tasked with reporting these deaths? And to answer that question, you really have to look at the electronic death registration system, which is this piece of technology that hospitals are using, that medical professionals are using to certify these deaths. And so what the coroners are also saying, too, is that part of why they believe they should be able to better help with these, you know, the reporting of COVID-19 deaths is that it would take the burden off of medical professionals who, you know, let them focus on treating patients. They should not be worried about trying to, you know, use this new piece of technology to you know, properly record the death into this system. You know, it's a particular burden when somebody dies with a pending COVID-19 death, the physician who attended to this patient is later required, once the test results come back, either positive or negative, to go back into the technology and confirm whether or not that test came back positive. So what the coroners are saying is, look, like let us take that burden from the medical professionals. They don't need to be in charge of that. Let them focus on treating the patients.
So who do the hospitals and nursing homes report to directly?
So they record the deaths into this EDRS system, and the state runs this EDRS technology, which then it sends the death data up to the CDC. The certifying the deaths is all happening through this technology.
Do the coroners have access to that information? Do they get it as quickly as state health officials and the CDC or not?
That's something else that I discovered in my reporting is that, you know, if all goes as it should, coroners should be notified of these deaths. They do have access to the EDRS system. They are supposed to be up and running on it. And if a hospital reports a death into the EDRS system, the coroner should be informed of it. And in fact, that's what the coroners are saying. They, you know, I'm speaking with some of them. They say they don't need to investigate every single COVID-19 death, confirmed or suspected, but they do need to be notified of them. And what I was learning in my reporting was that some of the coroners were saying, look, we're not even being notified of these deaths. Now, the medical professionals do have 4 days to report COVID-19 deaths into EDRS. And again, that goes to the coroner's argument that, you know, if the state wants quick, fast, accurate reporting, don't rely on the medical professionals. Again, they should be treating patients, not worrying about reporting these deaths into the system.
I'm talking to Sarah Simon, reporter with Spotlight PA. What about people who die at home? Who's reporting that? And are officials determining if those are COVID-related?
Deaths that occur at home should be communicated to coroners and medical examiners, definitely. Now, the CDC has issued new guidance to say that COVID-19 can be reported on a death certificate, even if no test was issued. And so for that regard, if a coroner doesn't have enough tests, they can kind of use their best medical judgment in order to, you know, report a COVID-19 death. If they do have tests, what I'm hearing in Pennsylvania is that they have a limited number. Many coroners don't have any tests at all. And those who do are being encouraged by the state health department to use them sparingly. So that's, you know, to ask family members, people who came in contact with the deceased, you know, did they have a fever? Did they have a cough? Did they have difficult breathing? Or, you know, did they have any known community transmission with somebody who had COVID-19? The big question here that I'm hearing from coroners, or the big concern, I should say, is well, okay, say we test the deceased, or say we don't, and we presume, you know, we call them a probable COVID-19 death. What does that mean for their family, right? Are we missing their family if we, in our the accuracy of the case count, if we can't get tests for everybody, you know, how do we know that we're really accurately tracking how this virus is spreading?
What are the implications of all this? If there are more people we should be counting among those who have died, I can imagine it might change our perception of whether Pennsylvania is actually flattening the curve.
Definitely. I think that, you know, there's economic implications to this too, right? How do we know if we're ready to open the state back up? If, you know, when should businesses be allowed to, you know, go back to work? When should people go back to work? If we don't know, if we don't have an accurate understanding of how this virus is spreading, you know, how will we ever know that? I think too, you know, if we think, you know, a few years into the future about looking back, trying to understand how this virus spread and, you know, what kinds of people, the demographics, the pre-existing medical conditions. I think if we don't have an accurate count now who this virus is affecting, it will make it, you know, much harder in the future to understand what happened and to answer some questions that we're not even thinking about yet because, you know, they might not have even occurred.
Sarah Simon is a reporter for the News Partnership Spotlight PA. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As of yesterday, local and state authorities had released roughly 950 people from the Allegheny County Jail due to fears over the coronavirus. But 90.5 WESA's Unley Herring reports the jail also houses about 250 people being tried in federal court, and federal prosecutors are making it much harder for them to be released.
Michael Broglie has been in Allegheny County Jail for 9 months on a federal drug conspiracy charge. His sister, Denise Puglisi, says he agreed to plead guilty for a sentence between 8 and 14 months, which means, in theory, he could be set free today. But the court hearing where that would happen isn't scheduled until July, and with cases of coronavirus already found in the county jail, Puglisi is scared.
That he's going to get it and die. I don't sleep. He shouldn't be there. He has uncontrollable high blood pressure, and he shouldn't be there.
Jails and prisons can be hotbeds for coronavirus. The infection rate at New York City's Rikers Island Jail, for example, is over 7 times that of the city itself. The number of cases in Chicago's Cook County Jail has soared to more than 30 times the rate outside its walls. Puglisi says her brother could stay with her on home confinement and that she would make sure he doesn't miss his next hearing.
I mean, I offered to pay for the monitor. He has a place to go. He's not going nowhere.
Broglie's attorney has asked to have his client put on house arrest or to have his hearing scheduled for next month. Prosecutors hadn't responded before this story was filed, but they haven't shown much interest in releasing anyone early. The federal public defender for Western Pennsylvania, Lisa Freeland, says court-appointed lawyers have requested more than 40 corona-related releases. She says many of those were for people eligible for home confinement or early release, but U.S. attorneys have opposed all but one of them.
If you look at some of the responses that have been filed and some of the orders that have been entered, the narrative is that, you know, COVID-19 is a problem, but it's not a problem that we're going to address for this population.
That outlook contrasts sharply from local courts, where prosecutors often haven't opposed and sometimes even assisted efforts to expedite hundreds of releases. ACLU of Pennsylvania legal director Vic Volchek says he thinks the Fed's harder line approach starts at the top.
From the president to the Justice Department on down, they are just more resistant to releasing anybody.
Federal authorities have released prisoners from some hard-hit facilities. And in a statement, Western Pennsylvania's U.S. Attorney Scott Brady says his office weighs inmates' health needs when responding to a request for release. But Brady says federal law precludes freeing people who pose a danger to public safety or are likely to flee. Former federal prosecutor Bruce Yankoviak says these are key concerns.
Imagine, if you will, the reaction if an individual who was released pretrial committed another very serious offense. That will cause the kind of public outcry that is really going to shake the system down to its very foundations.
In court filings, federal prosecutors and judges have argued that people behind bars face the same risk from coronavirus as anyone else. Data suggests that isn't true, and Yankoviak has his doubts.
As much as the prison system makes an effort to try to keep people safe, I don't think anyone's ever held up a prison system as being the societal model of good health care.
Freeland warns that prisoners who contract the virus can end up in public hospitals or transmit it to staff who live in the wider community.
And reducing the prison and jail populations now, because of that reality, will save the lives not only of our clients who are incarcerated, but prison and jail staff and people in the broader community.
That's why, in a pandemic, Freeland says the best way to protect public safety is to set some prisoners free. Anlie Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the space of just a few weeks, the response to the coronavirus has forced people throughout Western Pennsylvania and the world to overhaul their daily lives. The pandemic presents a dual challenge for transit agencies. 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause talked with Port Authority CEO Catherine Kellerman about how the agency is balancing dramatically lower ridership with increased cost and risk.
Port Authority just started this new campaign, and it reads "Stay Home, Save Lives" on the digital scroll on its buses. That's a pretty counterintuitive message for a transit agency.
That's an interesting way to put it. So we have a couple of things going on. Work trips and essential trips take a lot of different shapes and they look very differently for a lot of people. We want to make sure that we can get you on those essential trips. We are a mass transit agency, but in the universe of social distancing, we want to make sure we don't have too many people on the bus. And in order to ensure that we have adequate room for these folks who are doing their critical to and from work trips, we want to make sure that other folks are, you know, if you can stay home, please do. Don't expose yourself and don't expose our Port Authority staff.
I think a lot of people understand what social distancing means for them when they're at home or in their neighborhoods. But what does it look like for Port Authority, for your day-to-day operations?
With a full schedule, we can absolutely accommodate distancing. But then we're bringing a lot of our operators out to be driving buses that only have one or two people, and we have to balance that exposure. Only half our buses have the security area, the barrier between the operator and the front door. So how do we make sure those folks feel comfortable and they're clean? So it's making sure that we have a minimum level of service which connects people, and then also allows us to focus our buses to some neighborhoods or places where, you know, maybe 40 people have to be at work at 6 o'clock on one of our routes, and we can't carry them safely with one bus now. So can we move some of those unused buses over to those routes? We also are disinfecting every bus and every train every night, making sure that every vehicle is clean when it goes out, but making sure that we're as clean and safe as possible for the folks who work with us.
Port Authority is this essential service that has to keep running, but you're working with way less funding because ridership has plummeted, which is a good thing as far as health goes, but how do you balance those two pressures?
Wow, when we figure that out, I'll call you back. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I'll refer to Jarrett Walker, who is a big name in American transportation planning. And he was recently quoted saying, you know, it's not ridership right now, it's preventing the collapse of civilization, which sounds really melodramatic, but I would rather someone stay home and be safe than have them be counted as a passenger. Absolutely, safety is a top priority.
Congress approved a federal stimulus bill that included $25 billion for transit agencies. Port Authority expects to see roughly $141 million. Besides filling a short-term budget hole, what do you expect that money to do?
You know, our ridership is down up to 80%, depending on where you look. Revenue is also down about 94%. So we will be looking to plug in all of our missing pass and passenger revenues with that money. We also are paying out a chunk of overtime to the folks who are sticking around to disinfect our vehicles. And as you can imagine, that's a lot more disinfecting supplies. We are, like every other transit agency and many businesses which are open now, scrambling to get our hands on surgical masks. So we'll be covering that through our stimulus funding.
This pandemic has revealed for a lot of people just how essential workers like transit operators and grocery store clerks and healthcare professionals are. But has the drastic change in the way we go about our lives revealed anything to you about how transit operates or could operate in the region?
It really underscores some of the unique things that we deal with at Port Authority. To wit, in 2007 and in 2011, 2012, we had big service reductions tied to changes in state funding. And we have people who still come to meetings. Someone would come up and say, you moved my bus 12 years ago and I want it back. We have so much, not even unmet demand, but it's demand that we abandoned.
Catherine Kellerman is CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's Catherine Kellerman talking with 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's show and past programs can be found at wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Helen Wigger, Kylie Kaczynski, and Megan Harris. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Please be safe, and I hope you have a good day of good news.